Dear listener, welcome to the show.
What show? Viral.
And this is
Viral.
Never gets old.
It never does, although it might be ear-shattering for the people that are doing the audio
Those
for us.
Poor
so,
dear listeners.
So, Megan.
Well, hello.
Now that I guess there's no mystery as to what we're doing today, we are talking about our great state, the Sunshine State, even though you and I are both originally from Michigan.
That's exactly right.
So I do want to make that acknowledgement. Right. This is not our home state. But it is a state that we call home now. And, you know, as for many of us, home is a complicated place.
It sure is. You are not wrong.
There are Florida men. Women, Ooh. Animals, and history. Anyway, before we get started with our episode about Florida, let's set those olfactory levels.
Yankee Candle Corner. So, sniff, sniff, in preparing for an episode about Florida, which admittedly doesn't smell right.
As we've said many times on this podcast.
Yes, which I believe deeply in my soul. I went with something, and you knew it was coming, musky.
It's very musky here.
It is quite musky. So this smells good. Yum, yum. This is called amber and sandalwood,
Ooh.
As we knew it would. Top note, initial impression. Pepper, tonka bean.
What is a tonka bean?
It's like the little trucks.
But it's a bean?
Unsure. Yeah. Okay. But this is what it smells like. So if you're wondering, go grab a candle. And cardamom. We love cardamom.
Oh, I do love cardamom. Okay.
Main body, caramel, lavender, and amber.
I did not get any lavender from that, but Same. Go off.
Same. Yeah. You do you, Yankee. The base note, the final impression, the lingering essence, which is where we live, cedar wood, sandalwood, vanilla, and of course, the muskiest of all. The patchouli.
Yeah, it did feel like we were in a hippie locker room.
Ooh, oh yeah. Like kind of sweaty, yeah. But also woke.
We're really selling this.
Yes, yes. It's actually a lovely scent.
It is a lovely scent. And honestly, I love sandalwood.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful scent.
It is.
Florida, you know, It's
hot here.
It's hot here. Okay. And not to sidetrack us. One time James and I
never.
Yeah, right. One time James and I tried to make sourdough from the wild yeast of the Tampa Bay area. And I'm not kidding, it tasted swampy.
Oh,
but and also weirdly cheesy.
Oh, yeah.
Which feels
bacteria.
Right.
Bacteria.
And also it was not good.
Mm, yeah, it feels right because it's not right. Because
it's wrong.
Yeah, because it's wrong. Well, that tracks.
Well, speaking of things that are right because they're wrong. So, Megan, when you think of Florida and public health, tell me some of your initial impressions or initial thoughts. Give me that word cloud.
Oh, my gosh. This is like an ink blot. Logical fallacies.
Cool.
The political bastardization of common sense.
Yep.
I don't know. Are there more? Those are my initial.
I love those as your first initial takes.
Yeah, Florida doesn't strike me as a place that does public health very well.
Yeah.
Because we have actual quantitative data to show that Florida does not, in fact, do public health very well.
We rank high in bad areas and low in good areas.
It's because the good areas are in Florida.
Yeah. Mm. Like, you know, like positive maternal outcomes, we rank low in that, but really high in health disparities.
Right. Super.
So, but you know what? Before we even get into that, I want to talk a little bit about the First Peoples of Florida.
Okay.
And before we do that, I do want to make a land acknowledgement.
Okay.
Every community owes its existence and vitality to generations from around the world who contributed their hopes and dreams and energy to making the history that led to this very moment. Some were brought here against their will. Some were drawn to leave their distant homes in hope of a better life, and some have lived on this land for more generations than can be counted. Truth and acknowledgement are critical to building mutual respect and connection across all barriers of heritage and difference. We begin this effort to acknowledge what has been buried by honoring the truth. Many of us on this podcast are sitting on the ancestral lands of the Tocobaga and Seminole people. We pay respects to the elders past and present, so please take a moment to consider the many legacies of violence, displacement, migration, and settlement that brings us together here today, and please join us in uncovering such truths at any and all public events and other places. Actually, all the time. How about just all the time? Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you,
Liz. Yes, of course. So let's talk a little bit about the indigenous peoples of Florida, because I think sometimes we're like, oh, let's start talking about, you know, like the European settlers as if that was the starting point. It was not. People have lived in this land for a very long time, much before European settlers came here. Those people include the Seminole, which I do want to point out the Seminole are made up of other tribes. The Miccosukee, the Colusa, the Timucua, and many others, like I said, right here actually in the Tampa Bay area, we have the Tocobaga tribe. They actually came, they were here long before European settlers.
Which is amazing because she a swamp.
It is hard to live here now. We have air conditioning.
That is true. The full force of like late stage extractive capitalism to make my life not irritating. And it is irritating on a day-to-day basis in Florida.
Also, agriculture is real hard here.
Bro, there's no vegetables here.
There's no vegetables. There's fruits.
Yeah.
There's seafood. And actually, for many of the folk, many of the indigenous peoples that lived on the coastlines, that was like their main diet was, you know,
fruit and seafood.
Fruit and seafood.
That makes sense.
And, you know, here, if you know any of the history of the St. Petersburg area, we had mounds of shells, right? And those mounds of shells were essentially detritus, right? Like people were eating oysters and clams, and then they'd throw the shells and they'd create these mounds. And then they also essentially became sacred to those peoples and were a part of the ecosystem in the area. So a lot of these native communities had rich and diverse cultures. We do know that. And they all had, you know, their own health practices that were deeply rooted in their connection to the land. Obviously, the way that they subsisted was through hunting and fishing and gathering. There was some farming, but I don't think that it was a lot because we have struggled to even have agriculture here in the state of Florida for a long time, even though now I feel like we're known for our strawberries and pineapples and whatever. But for the longest time, people didn't even want to really call us a colony because they couldn't get anything from us.
We couldn't make our own food.
Yes, it really
wasn't. I mean, it's sand. The ground is sand.
Right. And it wasn't until they discovered phosphate in the state of Florida. Oh, boy. That's when business started.
That's a charged topic. Yeah.
Yeah, right. A lot of the indigenous peoples lived in villages that consisted of thatch roof homes called chickies, which were elevated to protect against flooding and pests. These communities were often located near bodies of water, providing access to food and transportation. This was a vibrant place for indigenous folks, despite the harshness of the environment. Yeah. Unfortunately, the colonization of Florida led to the displacement and relocation of many of the indigenous peoples that lived here. I mean, one of the things I think most of us immediately think of, especially in terms of public health, are the introduction of diseases like smallpox, measles, influenza, and these things devastated these populations. And unfortunately, adding to that was, of course, conflict and even forced labor.
Yeah.
When we talk about the brutal reality of colonization in terms of public health, I mean, certainly, you know, the introduction of communicable diseases, as well as just industrial and political violence in trying to take lands from them. We do have recognized tribes in the state of Florida, but many of them were forced to move through the Trail of Tears. Many of them were moved to places like Oklahoma, you know, out of the state of Florida because of Andrew Jackson, you know, the guy that we put on the $20 bill.
Yeah.
So there's that. And of course, many perished in the Trail of Tears as well. So that's kind of like, I know that's like sad, but I do, I will say I am happy to see that there is more recognition of the indigenous peoples here in the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. It's always complicated, especially when you've got political factors like, well, like our political government.
Oh, that.
You know, but I will say, as of this episode, they did strike down the Stop Woke Act. So
yeah, which yes, is they great. Did.
Yay, appeals court, I guess. Know. So let's talk about the 19th century, right?
Okay. Then what happened?
Florida faced significant public health challenges. To no one's surprise.
No one is surprised Florida's struggles in any realm, actually.
Let's count the public health challenges.
Oh, God.
That there are.
Soul-crushing heat.
Remember how we talked about.
Dr. Jory?
Well, I was just going to say, remember how we talked about the mini ice age?
Yes.
The little ice age?
Yes.
Well, it got a little bit hotter here after the little ice age, which provided fertile ground for the spread of infectious diseases, which made it pretty hard, especially during a time where we had a limited understanding of how diseases were transmitted, to safeguard people, right?
Yeah. And everything here bites.
Mosquitoes love it here. We know that they are reservoirs for every kind of disease you can think of. So there's that. We had outbreaks of yellow fever, malaria, and cholera. Yellow fever and malaria are spread by mosquito. Cholera is waterborne. And as you know, this is a swamp. Access to potable water isn't always, you know, available. I know. Basically, Florida is the perfect, it is the petri dish of just.
You ain't wrong.
You know, every infectious disease you can think of. So quarantine stations were established along major transportation routes to screen incoming travelers for signs of illness. Because as we started to understand germ theory and transmission, we did have some public health measures put into place. As the sanitation movement happened and we started realizing that, you know, having being exposed to dirty water and trash and garbage wasn't good for our health. It will kill you. As well as, you know, these are certain hygiene practices that we should all incorporate into our lives. Things started to get better, and that's not just for the state of Florida. That was for everybody,
yeah, sure.
Right?
All right?
So we had waste disposal, sewage management, access to clean water. That made it a lot easier to just live your life versus being like, well, gosh, I hope I don't die of tuberculosis.
Yeah.
You know? And actually, Florida did have a tuberculosis hospital in, I believe, like north central Florida that just recently closed in the last 10 years.
Really?
Mm-hmm. They had special ventilation systems. And what's interesting about that is it closed right before COVID.
Oh.
I know.
Timing is everything.
Timing, right? Because they were like, well, we don't really have the same kind of outbreak.
Yeah.
We don't have the same outbreaks of TB as we normally do. And then,
The plague.
And then the plague. Additionally, as we started to understand mosquitoes as a, you know, formidable public health threat.
Yes.
We started to implement a more comprehensive infrastructure for mosquito control. And that became a critical component of Florida's public health strategy in at least combating diseases like yellow fever and malaria. Obviously, later on, we're looking at diseases like Zika, chikungunya. Yeah. I know you're looking at me like chikungunya, dengue fever.
Dengue, yep.
So pretty important. I don't know if you've noticed, but there's always some kind of like campaign for, hey, make sure you throw out your standing water because mosquitoes can, I think it's like a tablespoon of water they can I know, right? Yeah, it's not great.
You can't eradicate all tablespoons of water in your yard.
I know. Just ask Megan about bromeliads.
Oh my God, I hate bromeliads. They are terrible. I don't even think that they are pretty. I don't understand the appeal, and they are just little misery buckets.
I love it.
They are miserable to plant. They're miserable to rip out. They're miserable to prune.
You better be careful. Big bromeliad is going to come right after.
Big bromeliad. Oh, even little, like any size bromeliad is a prickly, itchy nightmare.
Sure is.
Oh, man. Yeah, no, we are a bromeliad-free family.
Oh, my gosh. Well, unfortunately, as we all tried to figure out ways to get rid of mosquitoes, one of those efforts was draining swamps and marshes.
Because you can drain water off of the earth. That is, you can take water out.
And if we drain the swamps and marshes, maybe we can use it for agriculture, like sugarcane or other things, right?
Yeah. All right.
Well, you know, funny story. There's a reason why swamps and marshes exist in a place where it floods constantly.
Is it because it floods constantly?
Yeah. How did you know?
No, I don't know. I just guessed.
It's so funny because growing up, in a very rural part of Michigan, there was always the joke of, like, you know, if you were trying to scam somebody over, you'd say something like, oh, and I got a couple acres of swampland you want to buy. And now I think about it and I'm like, you guys, that's like not a scam. Like, we need to protect our swamplands. Like,
we should make it into a conservatory.
Yeah.
Get a lawyer.
Hey guys. Yeah. Yeah. It's actually not a joke, guys. I mean, at least I think about that. I'm sure my dad's still making that joke.
But I imagine.
So we, unfortunately, some of our marshes and swamps got drained in order to, I guess, in the pursuit of killing mosquitoes, but also in being like, hey, maybe we can make money off of it. And of course, just throughout the 19th century, we saw outbreaks of infectious disease, sporadically. We had, you know, things like yellow fever and malaria were essentially endemic to Florida.
Yeah.
The establishment of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta was because we had endemic outbreaks of disease in the South, because Florida isn't the only stanky place. It's humid.
Louder.
All over the South, right? So they kind of needed to have like a place where everybody could, you know, try and figure out ways to make sure that people weren't dying of communicable disease.
That is noble.
It's absolutely, absolutely noble. And I will just say, it was very hard to live here again. Not just because of how hot it was, not just because of the lack of infrastructure, but again, like, if you're having to deal with endemic disease without vaccines, without the medical infrastructure, you know, you're going to see high rates of morbidity and mortality. And again, we really didn't have effective medical treatments for a lot of those diseases. And so that led to, you know, a lot of folks dying. In fact, if you go over to Egmont Key, which is here in the Tampa Bay area, there's a small little cemetery, and most of those people died of yellow fever. Yeah, and that's really common for a lot of older cemeteries in the state of Florida. So, but, you know, we continue to try and figure things out, which, you know, leads us into the 20th century.
We continue to try to make the inhospitable wetlands property for aging Midwestern folks who want to live at adult day camp.
Yeah, which is wild to me.
Oh, yeah. Like, the villages are wild.
Oh, and honestly, you know, we see in the 20th century the most, like, just huckster kind of behavior. People being like, come to Florida. It's a health oasis. You know, come and swim in our springs. And people selling paradise. But then they get there and there's like,
it's the fucking villages.
In hospital. Yeah. Well, no, the villages hadn't even been created. But we are this never-ending cycle of just real estate scams. And that's
hucksters.
Just hucksters.
Bring it back. Hucksters.
Right? Bring it back.
What
hucksters.
Were they selling? What was the actual deliverable in paradise? It was like a condo and like an Orlando suburb?
Actually, one of the communities in Miami.
Wow.
Which I. Wow. I know you're not going to be surprised by that. But essentially, they created all of these brochures saying, you know, buy a piece of land in this beautiful, you know, intercoastal island. You know, they sold all these parcels, right? Turns out there was nothing there. Like, there was land, but it hadn't been cleared. The railroad system wasn't widespread enough for them to actually get building supplies there. And so people were making, they were scamming people up north out of money, thinking that they were coming down to this amazing place that was ready to go and ready to build. So
they're like, we can't even get there.
There isn't
even a road. There's for not the trucks even a road. That make roads.
Yeah, exactly. There's not even exactly. That's exactly it.
Cool. That tracks.
But people kept coming, right? Like, Florida's population kept growing. And of course, because populations increase, we see, of course, you know, public health infrastructure needed.
Right.
Even though it may not be there. If there's no roads, there's probably not a lot of public health measures going on.
Yeah, so. That's fair. That's a bit of a predictive piece.
Yeah. The Florida State Board of Health was founded in 1889, and it played a crucial role in improving sanitation, controlling infectious diseases, and promoting public health education across the state. You know, once we had sanitation programs, vaccination campaigns, and, you know, they worked really hard to basically reduce the burden of infectious disease. Even as people were coming down and being like, wait a second, this was all a scam. Don't worry, we'll make sure you don't get bit by a mosquito.
Maybe.
You know? Maybe.
We don't know. We'll reduce the chances that you get bit by a mosquito within a narrowly defined set of circumstances.
Right. Yeah, because with the increase of people moving to Florida and trying to build, whether that's developments or infrastructure, that also meant coerced labor was also being used. So we had migrants coming in to be, you know, to build these spaces, right? And that also created its own issues around not just, obviously, I'm just going to call it industrialized violence, but, you know, those folks are coming in and not getting the same kind of access to medical treatment kind of thing too. I do want to point out, during the Jim Crow era, Florida had a lot of lynchings. If you are familiar with the Rosewood area, which is up by Cedar Key, essentially the white inhabitants of Cedar Key burned down and murdered most of the people in Rosewood. This also happened in places like Ocoee, which is over by Orlando. If you've ever read The Devil in the Grove, mm-hmm. No relation, just kidding.
Yeah. But no, actually, no relation.
Yeah, yeah. Devil in the Grove is actually all about Ocoee and essentially how these young black men attempted to help a white woman and man who had been stranded and their car had broken down or something. And then they accused those men of rape. And essentially, they were all one by one, either murdered or basically lynched. So there was a lot of racial violence and terrorism in the state of Florida. It is a public health issue.
Yeah,
I do
absolutely.
Want to point that out.
Yep.
So that's why I bring it up. You know, we had these communities who, you know, were made up of freed slaves or the children of freed slaves who were just coming here to find or had lived here. Right?
Right. Yeah.
Actually, at one time, the state of Florida was being it wasn't a state at the time, actually. That Florida was actually being considered as becoming a territory for what they call for Negroes. In our history, before Florida became a state, the U.S. was like, you know what? We've got...
This is like a reservation model?
I was just going to say that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Right? They're like, well, we'll give them Florida.
Oh, my God.
Which, as we have all just learned, not a great state for just people to live in.
Yeah.
If you want to survive and even maybe live comfortably.
Right.
Yeah. So... Here we are.
So that sucked.
Yeah. You know, this, I will say, like, there were things that, you know, that there were good things that did happen, you know, that happened in the state of Florida when it comes to public health. You know, we, in 1996, we actually created the Florida Department of Health, which I was like, wow, in the 90s?
1996?
Yes.
The department, the Florida Department of Health?
Yes, yes.
You stop.
I'm not stopping.
There wasn't a Department of Health in the state of Florida until 1996? What were we doing? What were they doing?
Well, we had our state Board of Health, right? So essentially, the Florida Department of Health established county health departments for all 67 counties. And those county health departments were essentially a partnership between the state government and the county government for each county. And so we had boards of health, but it's just this was a more consolidated model. A lot of other states have this same model for public health departments. I don't know if Michigan is similar to that. I know that Michigan has county health departments, but I don't know if it's the same kind of partnership model between the county and the state or if there's more. I will tell you here, just as somebody who has worked for the health department, the state has way more power than the county does.
Which is weird because we're freer here.
We're so free.
We're freer. We're really free. That's what I've heard.
To get sick. Yeah. That's what we are. So...
But the freedom that we have here really requires a heavy state oversight, a heavy state hand for us to be so free down here in our little counties.
Yeah. and we did have, you know, political leaders that, you know, really did want to establish, you know, better public health policies around like maternal child health, like Lawton Childs. He was the governor of Florida. We actually have a building in the College of Public Health over at USF that's named after him. And he did a lot for like maternal child health policy. But yeah, that is a little bit of the history of public health in Florida. There's obviously a lot more. I pulled a lot of this from different things that I've read over the years. There's a really good, like short kind of like a brief history of Florida that is like really interesting. I would be remiss if I didn't talk about Florida and COVID. We're here.
Okay.
For our listeners, Megan is just writhing in her
seat. Florida's just... Although I do have... Okay, so we have thoughts. All right, so let's talk about Florida.
Tell me.
Well, in general, and I think we've talked... I don't know if we've talked about it on the podcast before.
Yeah.
But I do think that public health was myopic in addressing the legitimate business needs of people during COVID. Like everything became so politicized and it happened so quick. Yeah. And to be fair, there was so much like, COVID's no big deal, which was never true.
Yeah.
Right. But the lines were drawn. And then all of a sudden it was like public health was just like, everybody's home all the time. Everything's closed. Anything other than that is insane. Like, what are we doing? And I think being from Michigan and still working in Michigan. So seeing like Governor Whitmer's stance and then seeing DeSantis, I mean, you couldn't get
more polarized.
Yes. And I'm like, you know, literally every day kind of working between these two places. And I don't think public health had a good answer to the legitimate needs of people, especially people who were working minimum wage day labor jobs during COVID. We absolutely needed to quarantine. There were absolutely instances where people had to stay at home, but doing that for a year, for 6 months, even for 2 or 3 months wasn't a viable option in a state, in a country where we have absolutely no legitimate social safety net.
I was just going to say,
It wasn't tenable. I feel like it was myopic and there wasn't enough space to actually have those conversations. And, you know, DeSantis, like, and it wasn't what either DeSantis or Whitmer were doing, right? They were both the extreme to me, and there was something in the middle.
Yeah.
Like, I actually think Florida, and also by virtue of our climate, people could be outside all the time, really, that there were some parts of the response in Florida that I think were more geared towards the legitimate needs of people who are living at or near poverty.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, of course, 2020, or, you know, I should say, like, hindsight is 2020. But that's not to say that shit wasn't wild here.
Like, shit was wild here.
Yeah, I mean, I remember we had just gotten back from Toronto from a conference. It was March 9th, and I made a little timeline. So On March 1st, 2020, Governor DeSantis declares a state of emergency in the response to the COVID-19 pandemic. So we weren't even back from Canada yet. Hmm. And then March 9th, the Department of Health confirms its first cases of COVID in the state. And then on the 20th, DeSantis issues an executive order closing bars, nightclubs statewide, limiting restaurant capacity to 50%.
All right, so he closed bars and nightclubs.
And limited capacity in restaurants.
Okay.
Then on April 1st, that's when he issued the stay-at-home order. And directing residents to limit movements outside their homes to essential activities only. By the end of the month, they started a phased reopening plan.
By April 29th, 2020, Florida was like, bouncing back, baby. Let's back, get these baby. People
yep.
back.
Yep.
Let's
yep.
Oh, God. That's it right. Been, it's been 17 minutes. And Florida's like, we're good. Let's go back.
Right, because they started hearing the wails and shouts of people from the business community, right? Yeah. And not to say that, you know, again, I think that there is this... I think that there is a balance, right? Like, you're right. There, we don't live in a state where we have good social safety nets. I mean, I remember having this conversation with you about how we already had a terrible unemployment system.
Sure.
Right? Like, if you wanted to apply for unemployment in the state of Florida, good luck. Before COVID.
Right.
And now we've got this influx of people who are now unemployed into a system that was built to not service
That's
people.
Exactly right. Yeah, it was so, built to present barriers.
Exactly. So it's like, it's not COVID. It's the system. And when you put pressure on these systems, that's when you really start to see the cracks, right?
Yeah, or when you see what they were designed to do, right? The
right.
system was designed to not actually effectively right. move resources.
You will be punished if you are poor. That is, yes. On the 26th of June, so remember, we're in this reopening plan. We're getting back in the groove. DeSantis actually suspends on-site consumption of alcohol at bars statewide in response to a surge in COVID-19 cases.
So it surged, you're it saying? Surged, when we reopened in April 29th, 2020, yeah. we yeah. saw a surge in June. Well.
Right. And then right after the 4th of July, so on July 6th, Miami-Dade County issues a countywide curfew in response to rising COVID-19. Of course, we in the state of Florida hate home rule. Home rule is allowing local municipalities and counties to make their own laws based on the local context.
It right? is fucking federalism.
Yes.
It is the literal design of our government.
Yes. However,
Florida, free birdie.
I know. However, in Florida, the state government loves preemption. And so, and what preemption is a legal mechanism to pass a law that says you can't, local counties and municipalities cannot pass any laws that are stricter than what the state passes. So
oh, I hate it so much.
I know. So we see Miami-Dade issue this countywide curfew. The state's like, hold up.
Be Wait like DeSantis
yeah.
in.
Yeah, 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 right. So then in September, we have phase three of reopening, which allowed all businesses to operate at full capacity with limited restrictions. Guys, this was September 25th, 2020.
it was, yeah.
DeSantis was like, COVID, come at me, brah.
Yeah. Meanwhile, as public health people, I mean, we yeah. were just... watching horrified,
yeah.
just masked up, mouths agape
yeah.
at what was happening.
And having a mask was starting to become
That's right.
politicized.
Oh, I forgot. Yeah. You couldn't, you, I mean, there are times I fear walking around in Florida looking the way I do just on a normal day, but then put my ass in a mask and I was like, we gotta go.
Yeah. You could be assaulted at a grocery store. People could purposefully cough on you. I mean, it was wild. It still is wild. Don't get me wrong. Like, it still is wild. So then on December 11th, so remember, on the 25th, DeSantis is like, listen, looks like we made it. And then December 11th, Florida received its first shipment of COVID-19 vaccines. So we didn't even have the vaccines before we were like, everybody, let's get out and party.
Right.
And then, of course, vaccines created a whole other political firestorm.
Yes, yes.
In 2021, on March 29th, DeSantis signs an executive order prohibiting vaccine passports. If you guys remember the whole vaccine passport debacle, which bans businesses from requiring proof of vaccination.
Freedom.
Freedom. Then on May 3rd, he signs legislation that prohibits local governments from enforcing mask mandates and imposes fines on businesses that require masks. Remember the home rule stuff?
Oh my God, dude. They prohibited
people
from requiring masks.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hate all of this.
Because remember, you know, Miami-Dade did this countywide curfew on July 6th. And for those of you that aren't familiar with how our legislature works in the state of Florida, technically we have a part-time legislature. And so our legislature meets at the beginning of the year, either starting on January or starting in March, depending on if it's an odd or even year. And session is like 90 days or something like that. So they had to wait, right, to basically do this preemption.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And so that means they were stewing mad for so long about Miami-Dade enacting its own curfew. Yeah, right. Then in August, we experience another surge. Fueled by the Delta variant. And then in December of that year, we continue our vaccination efforts and encourage booster shots, even though we have a Surgeon General, Dr. Latipo, who is a COVID vaccine conspiracy theorist.
Super.
Yeah. So we had a state legislator who was going through chemo, who was really pushing for more public health measures. He went to her office without a mask to basically like make, quote unquote, make a point. This guy's wild.
Wow, point taken. Yeah. You suck, brah.
Right? And of course, like, we had lots of pushback on vaccines, not just from Dr. Latipo, but from our great governor. And we still have a lot of vaccine hesitancy here, which is really, in my mind, it's just really sad because we have so many vulnerable populations in this state.
That's true. We should.
You know, and those same vulnerable populations are ones that believe in COVID conspiracy theories, which is just upsetting. We had a couple of, you know, really right-wing, like, shock jocks that ended up passing away from COVID because they refused to get vaccinated.
Error.
And I will just tell you, as somebody who worked in the state of Florida in the public health department, it's tough. It's not a well-paying government agency. Many people get burned out really quickly. It is highly political, so, you know, it makes being a citizen outside of your job really hard because there's always a fear that it's going to get back to your supervisor that you're doing XYZ. And again, like, when you don't have a well-funded public health infrastructure, it's really hard to do public health well.
Yeah, it is.
And it's not to say that money is going to solve everything, but I think that where we direct our funds is a direct indicator of where our priorities are.
Yeah, what we value, for sure.
Exactly. So that's public health in Florida.
Cool. All right. Well, I guess we have a reason to keep showing up
as practitioners.
I guess. Yeah. All right. Fine.
I do want to say that I am so thankful and am continually amazed by the work that public health practitioners do in this state.
Yeah.
Because it can be extremely frustrating. It can be soul-sucking. But we actually do have some great public health schools here. I will say the recent legislation around whether or not we can talk about diversity, equity, inclusion in our higher education institutions makes it, I think, extremely difficult for training the next generation of public health practitioners. Yeah. I don't understand how you can't talk about systemic racism while you're also talking about health disparities. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. And I think that we're putting our public health workforce at a disadvantage when we don't give them the full scope of what drives negative public health outcomes. So I just want to say kudos to, you know, those that are still working in the health department, those that are still working in hospitals, you know, those that, you know, honestly, anybody that stayed in public health after COVID-19.
Is it anybody who's here? We are so grateful that any of you are here.
Thank you so much.
Don't ever leave us.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one thing I really fear is that we already have an underfunded infrastructure here in the state of Florida. That also means that we may not be attracting anybody to fill the spaces when people retire or they decide that they can't do it anymore or, you know, for whatever reason. So we already know that there's going to be a shortage in the public health workforce when, you know, a lot of folks retire who have worked in public health for a long time. So, but I'm encouraged. When I was teaching undergrads, I did see a lot of young people in Gen Z who were really interested in public health and wanted to do something really meaningful. So that really made me feel good, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if you actually are paying attention to the world and the kind of the mainstreamness of systemic violence, of systemic mm-hmm. disadvantage, of areas that are designed, right? Like mm-hmm. areas of historical poverty, areas of blight, like, and how policy actually creates and defends those types of areas. Like, public health is certainly amenable to that. To people who really want to work in justice space, right? There is a very clear path to public health as a way to do that.
Yeah.
And to your point, like, Florida saying that you can somehow disentangle public health with equity and justice work, it's not possible.
Yeah.
Public health, from the jump, I mean, and I'm not, again, we've done a distrust in public health, so it's not like public health hasn't been a part of
the problem.
of maintaining and perpetuating systemic issues. And we're still kind of unpacking our manufacture of the quote unquote obesity epidemic, right?
Yeah.
And public health, when done well, right, is about understanding the social and environmental drivers mm-hmm. of health.
Yeah.
So you cannot do public health if you can't talk about racial injustice or, you know, heteronormativity or all of these things that structure the world in which we live. So then public health can't be done in Florida. Then, like, you can't study public health in Florida, right? Yeah. If you're going to cut the legs out, then, like, okay, we need to understand that and either go after this, you know, have a long game of addressing, right, that real gap in public health education in Florida, and have a short game of, okay, how are we going to make it appealing for people who do public health from a justice perspective? How do we get them to come here?
Yeah.
And I don't know, because I'm here and I don't know why. I have no idea why I'm
all
here.
All my friends are here. It's hard to leave.
I know. God, that's the problem.
I know, right?
All right. Well,
yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, policy shift over time. And I do think that, you know, it's wild to me that people are still moving here, but
fair.
I mean, just even looking at climate change, it's wild to me that people are still moving here.
Yeah. You're going to take out a 30-year mortgage.
Good luck.
Yeah.
Good luck,
okay.
My friend.
No, Godspeed.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I guess. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, literally start praying. Yeah. Because
it's God's plan.
Words of Drake.
Yeah. But, you know, I also think that the folks that are moving here are going to shift political. I think it will shift the political landscape. I'm not entirely sure which way it's going to shift the political landscape. And I also think, too, that, you know, when you ignore the ripe inequities that we see all around us in terms of affordable housing, affordable health care, or even just access to health care, mm-hmm. The climate resiliency, the wealth gap, I just see our politicians sticking their head in the sand and or, you know, distracting them with, oh my gosh, they're going to turn your kids gay. You know, when we start to ignore those, like, really big systems things that actually are impacting, like, lots of people, you will bear the burden of that eventually. And it's not going to be a paradise for rich people, because guess what? The people that were working at the Don Cesar and bring you your towels and taking your orders, they're not going to be able to afford to live here. And they're not going to want to live here because it's just...
It's
inhospitable to
them. That's right. Yeah.
So, I mean, good luck with that, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's not going to be this paradise that you think that it is. As Florida always has been.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Florida, the paradise that you... That is not what you think it is.
Yes, that's exactly right. Not the paradise you were promised.
Yeah. Ooh. Mm. What a good book name.
Oh, my God.
Well, Megan, that is my little ditty on public health in Florida.
A hell of a tale it was.
It sure was. And it's still ongoing.
Yes, that's right.
So I do want to mention that if you'd like to support this podcast, which we hope that you do, especially if you're still listening at this point, you can support us by leaving us a review on whatever podcatcher you use. You can, you know, make sure you rate us. You can be so, so, so generous and even, you know, become a patron on our Patreon.
Ooh.
We now have a Ko-fi. It's Ko-fi. If you'd like to make a one-time donation, all of the funds go towards paying our audio engineer, the Kaboom Room.
Kaboom Room.
And we could not do this podcast without the amazing Michael Conrad.
Michael Conrad.
So, you know, please consider supporting our podcast. We do have some different levels. We are working on providing more content to folks because we know that you actually like us.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
I don't, yeah.
until we get that Yankee Candle money, we really
need... Ooh, that Yankee Candle money!
We do need a little bit of support, and we would really appreciate it. And if not, that's fine, too. We get that, you know, hey, sometimes you don't have it, and that's fine.
That's right. That's right.
If you want to learn more about us, you can visit our website at www.viral-pod.com. We'd also love to hear if you have other topics that you'd like us to talk about.
Yep.
We're always happy to take feedback from our listeners. So with that, make sure you wash your hands.
Yeah.
Especially in this state.
Yes, sweaty.
If you're
sweaty
in
palms.
Florida, yeah, you're probably sweating.
Yeah. Ooh. All right.